You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
Australia went to war against the emus. And what makes it so great is Australia lost. They lost the war.
What can they teach us?
Chris, that story really does illustrate human-wild conflict to like the highest degree that I think we've talked about on the podcast. I don't know if we've had anything like
a war. Like a war. Yeah.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
All right. So last week we started with something that sounded like a bird, and it was the capybara. This week, we start with something that should be a capybara, but we're actually doing a bird.
Or a drum. It sounds like a drum to me.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
But it's a big podcast today. We were talking about one of the most distinctive birds. Pretty iconic from Australia and humongous. One of the biggest birds. Second largest, correct?
Yep. We're going back down under again.
But we love you, Australia, and all of your amazing creatures.
We do. We do. And this one was specially requested. So, you know, we've done a string of Aussie animals just because I was just over there. But also this one came through and I told Angie we absolutely had to do this. And that was because one of our Patreon subscribers' name is Nick. His mother got it for him for his birthday. So he is a younger man that really loves the podcast, a budding conservationist. And for his birthday, he got a Patreon subscription, which was amazing. And so I spoke to his mom and I said, okay, what species does he want? And she said, well, he loves ratites. Emu's his favorite. I said, done. It's on the list. So this is for you, Nick. Plus, I just saw a couple in Australia in the Currumbin Wildlife Sanctuary. So that was really cool. And I've been itching to talk about this one, Angie, for a long time, because being across the Tasman Sea, there's this little bit of rivalry with Kiwis and Aussies. And, you know, I might tell some more jokes. But this one, the Great Emu War in Australia, It's a true story, and I cannot wait to tell it. It is, it cracked me up.
Well, yes, it's going to be a super fun podcast. And Nick, happy birthday, buddy. This emu is for you.
There you go. So yeah, wonderful species. Like, there's so many cool factoids about this.
So entertaining. It was a great recommendation. I love emus. They have them at my husband's zoo, the Santa Fe College Teaching Zoo. They're just the way they look, the way they walk, the way they move, everything. So, yeah, lots of fun physiological facts today. Mm-hmm. Some really cool parenting that we'll be talking about, and some really good dads. So that's always a fun one. So, yeah, stick around. I think you'll learn a lot today.
Yeah, it's a fun one. It's definitely a fun one. And yesterday, Angie and I had a live with our Patreon subscribers. And shout out to Melanie and the others that joined us on there. It was great. We actually turned over and went did Facebook Live after that, spoke to some folks. We're going to start doing that every month now. So we'll get that on the schedule. So you can check that out on our Facebook group, All Creatures Group, our Facebook page, All Creatures Podcast, our Instagram, All Creatures Podcast, and we'll be giving those dates out. But thank you so much to all of our Patreon subscribers. It means the world to Angie and I, and it's helping us keep the lights on, keep paying for producing this, and also the website running. So check that out too, allcreaturespod.com.
Yeah, and it was just so fun talking with Melanie yesterday and learning all about her volunteer work and how she her citizen science with eagles.
That's
so
right.
It was a great conversation and just like minds, us animal nerds hanging out together, talking, sharing ideas, sharing stories. So it's a great fun place to be. And of course, if you can't afford Patreon, as Chris mentioned, just join our All Creatures Podcast Facebook group, follow us on Instagram. And probably the easiest thing you can do if you haven't already is a 5-star review on iTunes with a little kind message. Always it goes pretty far for Chris and I.
Yeah, we love that. So switching gears, describing the emu, it's tall. I mean, it is tall. It is yes. tall. It's not as tall as an ostrich or an elephant bird, which we're going to talk about a little bit again today, or a moa, which is the other extinct rat height that went extinct mm-hmm. just a few hundred years ago in my backyard here in New Zealand. But it's a tall bird, you know, you can see eye to eye with it.
Yeah. I mean, in general, if you think of an ostrich, it has some similarities to that, but also some pretty big differences. To begin with, the plumage or the feathers of the emu are light to dark brown in color, and they're not perfectly streamlined, so it gives their feathers almost like this shaggy-like appearance. And depending on where the emu lives, there's going to be some environmental variation depending on the overall hue of the feathers. But just beautiful, I think, beautiful plumage on adults. And the chicks are pretty cool, too. They're actually born with dark brown with white longitudinal stripes running down from their neck all the way down their backs. It's just really unique, too. And researchers think this is to help give the chicks camouflage when they're younger and they're not as powerful and fast runners as the adults. So a big difference, too, between ostriches and emus, besides a slight variation in size, is the emus have these big bodies, mm-hmm. but really tiny wings.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a flightless bird, of course, and their wings of the emu are much smaller than an ostrich. The emu wings are only about 8 inches. They've been reduced down to like 6 to 8 inches, or like the size of our human hand. So they almost remind me of like T-Rex hands.
Yes.
They're
useless.
Just pretty,
yeah.
Where ostriches will open them up and will use their broader wings, bigger wings for a lot of communication, whether they're happy or sad or for courtship and things like this. But yeah, the emu just has this little T-Rex wing. Or best, I guess, I should use science terms since we're on a science podcast. Very small vestigial wings, capable mm-hmm. of flapping, but not helping in mobility or doing much for communications. And the neck of the emu is very long, similar to an ostrich. It's very sparsely covered in feathers. But what's super cool about the emu's neck is it has this like bluish green hue to it
mm-hmm.
with little gray to brown feathers sticking out, just kind of like a messy bedhead. And yeah, so
that's a good description. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then these wild or sparse feathers actually go atop of the head too. And to me, when you look at an emu straight on, their hair reminds me of like Einstein's hair in the posters mm-hmm. where he always looks like he just has bedhead, even
yes.
though he's like one of the most brilliant minds of all time. But his hair is just like wild. So yeah, their wispy black feathers on their head remind me of that. The face of the emu is beautiful to me. They have a large pointed beak, which is specialized for grazing. We'll talk a lot mm-hmm. about that. And they have beautiful red, amber, orangish colored eyes that really pop. So it gives them a very distinctive stare, I think, when they look at you. There's like they're thinking about something. And then lastly, of course, the feet. I have a whole one or two slides on mm-hmm. how powerful and amazing their feet are and some of the adaptations with that. But the emu's feet, of course, don't have any feathers on it. And they're very long and very powerful and typically like black, grayish in color. And we'll talk more about their feet in a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, their feet are quite unique and their musculature is very unique. But yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, when you're talking an ostrich 9 feet tall, towers over us, emus max out almost just less than 2 meters or like six and a half feet. So almost eye to eye with me. And I did take a selfie with an emu when I was in Australia. And I definitely was towering over this one. But it's, again, the way they walk and stand and stuff. Weight, 60 to 120 pounds, or that's almost up to 55 kilograms. So, but again, birds aren't heavy, you know, like mammals. But they are the second largest, like Andy said, the second largest bird in the world. They're larger than the cassowaries and the rheas, which are the other ratites. And then, of course, the kiwi, the tiny ratite in that family group. So, you know, just a big, funny, charismatic, like...
Oh, I could watch them all day.
Yeah, like...
just so entertaining, the way... Just the way they move and their the expressions they make on their face. And mm-hmm. like I said, just the sparse feathers on the head really do it for me.
Yeah. Wait to get to the Great Emu War. You'll see how aggressive they are. But, you know, they were free ranging at the sanctuary I was at where the cassowary was not. Just full of personality. Now, the range is very interesting, Angie. I did two things. I mean, obviously, you know, you have your normal map. Mm-hmm. Where you see they go, they do migrate, which I think you'll talk some about, right?
Of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the new map that I pulled out that I'm going to start doing, because I'm such an eBird nerd now. Thank you, Jesse. Is I went into eBird and looked at the map of all the emu sightings in Australia.
Where that is reported... fun. That's what I do with Fish and Wildlife in Florida for mm-hmm. all of the exotic, invasive, I should say, right. sightings in Florida. Yeah. The interactive maps are super fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this is where all the emu sightings have been in Australia. And it's pretty radical because it's awesome. Everywhere there's a reported sighting, pretty much matches up to where their range is. Now, some of the deep interior of Australia in the deserts mm-hmm. where like nobody, I mean, I'm sure somebody's living out there, but not many people, not many animals or creatures. Emus don't go there. They do go in some desert-like regions, but just not this interior of Australia, like up near Alice Springs. Mm-hmm. And then a little bit further west, you don't see them. But, and then of course the suburbs and around Sydney, Brisbane, you probably don't see them around Melbourne, Chantelle's area.
Well, it's always fun too, Chris, when we cover a species that's not endangered. So mm-hmm. emus are least concerned by the IUCN. And I saw that their population was around 700,000.
Yeah.
Depending on the seasonal rains each year. So that makes me really happy.
They are facing some challenges, but...
Of course.
But Australia's got, you know, more... species that need a lot of love and focus, like we were just talking, like the quolls or certain species of wombat or some of these other critically endangered animals that they're dealing with. But emus are doing generally well, like the kangaroos, you know, or the red kangaroos that we covered. Mm-hmm. Plenty of them running around all of the different biomes in Australia.
Oh, yeah, Chris, that really impressed me, too, how they're really flexible. They can live in savanna forests, subtropical climates, grasslands. So they do need water, so they do try to gravitate towards areas where they can find water. Mm-hmm, but, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, they want to stay out of deserts that don't have any water and then, I guess, really heavily wooded areas.
Yeah. And it's like
pretty flexible, right?
Yeah, a
generalist, for
yeah,
sure.
They're doing very well in Australia, where the cassowary is just up in that northern part
right.
of the tropics, where mm-hmm. the emu's there, too, but everywhere else in between. So doing very well in Australia. And, you know, very important to the biome there. And one of the things I looked at, Angie, was, so we keep talking seed dispersion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I learned this week about emus is they migrate pretty far. I wouldn't have expected that, right? For a rat type. Mm-hmm. So one of the things is... I came across was emus, certain plants have a specialized coating that during digestion through the emu's digestive tract, they have a greater chance of germinating and becoming entrenched in the ground and sprouting and growing, right? So they have this mutualistic relationship, I think that's the right word, where they'll go and graze or eat some of these certain plants, get the seeds, and then walk how many kilometers and then deposit it on the ground with some guano or poop, you know, that helps fertilize the seed, and then the seed sprouts. And so I found an interesting paper, and I'm just going to be on this briefly because I really want to get to the Great Emu War, but it was titled Emus as Non-Standard Seed Dispersers and Their Potential for Long-Distance Dispersal. And in general, they were just saying emus are just so important in maintaining plant health in the environment, these seed dispersers. So one of the things that got me really thinking, this paper stated that got me really thinking was, they stated that this is so important to gene flow in plants, and that the role that emus do in spreading these seeds and distributing these seeds as they migrate helps plant populations stay healthy and their genetics diverse. So again, resistance to disease, just like us, plants also have to resist certain diseases. And it got me thinking, like, how do plants pollinate, or how do plants spread their seeds? And they all have different strategies. You know, some attach to fur of animals and drops off, some blow in the wind. You know, you have some flowering plants. But these certain plants in Australia, and I didn't have the list of them. I didn't go that deep in the paper, but there's a list of plants that have some sort of relationship with emus. So whenever we talk about seed dispersal, I know we mention it quite a lot. Remember, that's such a critical part of, what do we call it? Ecological engineers?
You know? Sure. Yeah, they build, I was just going to say cities.
Yeah.
But they build up natural habitats and ecosystems, which include biotic factors, so anything that's alive, so the animals that we usually talk about in this podcast, but all of the plants and plant life too in the area. And then the ecosystem, of course, is going to consist of the abiotic factors as well, which are the non-living rocks and sand and dirt and climate and rainfall and other things that make an ecosystem what it is. And so, yeah, they are helping build up that particular ecosystem, the plant life there.
Yeah.
It wouldn't happen without them.
Yeah. And it goes back to the dodo and the dodo tree. And I know we covered that in a podcast of, I don't know how many ago. And there is still some controversy with the science with that. But basically, they're saying because the dodo went extinct, the dodo tree's going extinct because it needed the dodo to germinate the seeds. But I think they're saying the tortoise was more important now. I don't know. I don't remember it all. Anyways, the bottom line is they're very critical. And that's what makes this next story so tragic, or what could have been tragic, but it actually turned out to be more tragic for the Australians. And that's the Great Emu War in 1932.
Should I get my popcorn right now? Yes,
this is a,
I've got
this
my,
is a,
I've
I'm
got
going
my
to,
bubble water. Yeah.
I got my tongue in my cheek. But this one is a great story. So there was a Great Emu War.
And our listeners who aren't as familiar with Chris should know that he's a big war buff. So this is like,
I'm a history
animal,
guy.
Nerdy animal stuff, facts and historic war facts. So yeah. this is his jam.
So yes, it is.
I hope you enjoy. Grab your popcorn.
It is true.
But it's a cool story. It's a cool story.
It is. Australia went to war against the emus. And what makes it so great is Australia lost. They lost the war. To the emus.
Yes.
So Nick, you're listening.
Spoiler alert. Yes. The emus won. Big time. I would say big time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Whooped the Aussies. The Aussies. It was after World War One where the Aussies, it's a big thing down here too in New Zealand. The Anzacs. Great sacrifice in that horrific war that was just, the history of it just makes me so upset because it's just a horrific war. But the Aussies did help win that war. And then obviously World War II, So I'm not making fun of the Aussie military, but I am a little bit because they lost to a bird. Sarah's not flocking.
It wasn't one bird. It was a lot of emus.
It's like 20,000 emus. The bloodshed. Okay, here we go. Here's the story. So after World War One, you know, this horrible war, a lot of these soldiers came home and the government started dishing out land, in particularly Western Australia, for them to farm, you know, and I just thought that the trauma that all these poor soldiers, men and women, nurses, went through during that time. So they go out to Western Australia and they start establishing their farms. But obviously there's wildlife there, like the emu. And this is where I kind of learned that the emus migrate inland from the coast during the breeding season. So the great battles, a lot of these battles took place in Campion, Western Australia. And what happened was there's a lot of farmers there that were growing wheat. Well, an army of about 20,000 emus mounted an offensive on Campion, and they were hell-bent on not taking any prisoners. They were going to eat all that wheat no matter what. And so 20,000 emus came in, and you're going to find out how strong their legs are, but they had these rabbit-proof fences that they set up in Australia, and the emus trampled them down and then just started going to town and destroying all the crops, like eating all the wheat. And because they're such large birds, trampling all the crops. And, you know, I would say the emus won the first battle because they went in and took over the land and said, this is our land. Ha, ha, ha. Nothing you can do about it. You know, I could just see all these birds out there, all this wheat.
So totally.
The farmers were upset.
Rightfully so.
There's 20,000 emus. You know, you're come from a farming family. 20,000 emus destroyed your crops and your own livelihood. So the farmers went to the government and said, you have to do something because we can't fight these birds. We can't go out and do anything. So the next day, Australia declared war on the emu and said, okay. So they sent the military with machine guns to mount an offensive and push back the emus. Right. So
machine guns, automatic rifles
that pretty much killed like thousands and thousands and thousands of people horrifically in World War One. So they send these machine guns to kill the emus. So the first battle took place between the Australian army and the emus on the 2nd of November in 1932. And there was about 50 emus they saw. So they figured, okay, you know, this is a scout party. They're going to go find the main body. Kind of drive them and ambush them, right? So as this large herd of 1,000 emus was being kind of coming down, I don't know the whole story, but coming down this place where they were going to ambush them, the birds were smart. They sensed a trap and they took off and they broke into small groups, you know, and they were probably zigging and zagging and they made very difficult targets so that they start opening up with this machine guns. And they might have killed maybe 12 emu. That was it. They fired thousands and thousands of rounds, and they might have got a few birds, right? And so they pretty much, you know, it was a draw, score one to the emu because they didn't take that many casualties. But now the emus knew it was war. They're like, okay. So the second battle took place on the 4th of November. And again, another ambush where there was like 1,000+ emus that were heading towards this water source. And so they waited until the birds were at like point blank range where they couldn't miss with these machine guns. And they started to fire and the guns jammed and the emus got away.
Again,
I think maybe 10 emus were killed. So they scattered and that was it. And some think that the emus actually snuck into the army camp and like messed with the guns. So they might have had an advance warning. No, not really, but you never know. Okay. So then the final battle, 8th of November, the Australian army is getting killed in the press, making fun of them. They're losing this war to the emus. So they said, that's it. We're going in with everything we got. They went out with trucks and everything they could. They fired thousands of rounds, thousands and thousands of rounds of ammunition. And they ended up maybe killing 50 birds. Out of 20,000, The emus were just too fast, too smart, too quick.
Mm-hmm.
They were too much of a foe for the Australian army. So the government pulled the army out and said, that's it. You're on your own. We can't.
Hands up. Yeah, here's our white flag.
It's so of the day, an ornithologist of Dominic Cerventi said, the machine gunner's dreams of point blank fire into a seared mass of emus were soon dissipated. The emu command had evidently ordered guerrilla tactics, and its unwieldy army soon split up into innumerable small units that made use of the military equipment uneconomic. A crestfallen field force therefore withdrew from the combat area after about a month. The Australian army tucked its tail between its legs and waddled home on their trucks with their machine guns, and the emus stood victorious on the wheat fields of Campion, Western Australia.
Incredible. I'm still eating my popcorn. This is awesome. Who needs a big screen movie theater when you have a story like this? That is just...
I think they're making a movie. It's like a comedy, obviously.
Oh, man. But Chris, that story really does illustrate human wild conflict to like the highest degree that I think we've talked about on the podcast. I don't know if we've had anything like
a war. Like a war. Yeah. Against...
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, geez. It's
but
just...
thank goodness over time they're a lot has changed for emus and farmers and their relationship. First of all, I believe the emus are federally protected. So there's that. They don't have to worry about machine guns coming after them. So that's a bonus.
Yes.
But also, we'll talk about it when we get to nutrition and emus and how they're generalists. And they, of course, eat a lot of plant material and seeds, as Chris, Chris mentions. But they, being a generalist, yeah, they will eat some insects. And a lot of small insects will fall prey to the emus. And so certain farmers and ranchers throughout Australia have actually set up water sources for the birds to utilize and be attracted to, which lets the emus expand, of course, into areas that they wouldn't normally go to because it's either too dry or just not very habitable. And certain farmers and ranchers love the fact that the emus will eat caterpillars and grasshoppers and other insects that devastate crops. And some of the sheep farmers appreciate emus because the emus will eat this plant that makes like a really spiky burr. And then the sheep that they're farming wool for will actually get caught up and entangled in this burr. And so by having more emus around where the sheep are grazing, it keeps down some of the plants that are not helpful to the sheep. So a really mutual relationship and definitely not one so wrought with conflict, as Chris mentioned earlier.
Well,
I don't know if these are wheat farmers. I don't think these are wheat farmers I'm talking about, but certain farmers and certain ranchers, different crops, and depends on what they're for.
I think it was part of the armistice. The emus made sure that they got good terms of never again.
Exactly. I think what the farmers have found too, if they don't want emus around, they can fence things off. And they can't fly. They don't break through it. The fences
today versus probably 100 years ago are probably not as great. But I love that story. I love you, Australia. I really do. I'm so glad I'm living down this end of the earth.
I will say you sent me that one night and I was getting ready for bed and I'm like, okay, I got to read this. And I, I definitely turned my Netflix off and was like, okay, this is way more entertaining.
The Great Emu War, true story. All right. I have a good joke they like to tell down here in New Zealand about Aussies. So I'll tell that after the break, but we'll be right back.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Welcome back. All right, as promised, and I'm thinking of Chantel, and Chantel, this is nothing against you. You're brilliant. And, you know, I remember back in the Ray Kangaroo, and this is when, you know, we started really messaging, and she's been a great supporter of the podcast for years.
A good friend, yeah.
Good friend to both Angie and I. And I said, don't eat kangaroo meat, just don't. And she wrote back, you can't say that. We eat kangaroo meat down here all the time. But I didn't realize she was right. They do sell kangaroo meat in stores. I saw it there last month. And, you know, I apologize for that comment. Go ahead, eat your kangaroo. There are millions of them. A lot of them are sustainable. Some of the wallabies aren't, and we'll cover probably one soon in a while. But this joke is my favorite for the Kiwis over here. I always like to say, when a New Zealander moves to Australia, the IQ of both countries goes up. So take a minute and think about that.
My eyes are going left, right, left, right.
The IQs of both countries go up, meaning we lost a dummy in Australia, got smarter.
I get it. Yes, yeah.
Anyways.
Okay. That's a fun one.
Yeah, I know. It's just, I always crack up the Kiwis and Aussies. But yeah, love you both. Emu evolution, we've done rat types before. Pretty interesting. I mean, obviously bird is a large class, but you go to infra class to get to the rat types. And the ostrich, the rhea, the kiwi, the cassowary, and emu. So the only one we haven't done yet is the rhea. So maybe save that for next
year. That'll be fun, a South American friend for sure.
Yeah, I might do that. Now, in there is one flight bird. And that's the tinamous, 46 mm-hmm. species in the Americas. That's a rat type. So I covered this in ostrich a little bit, and I'll cover it again here in a second. But this is a bird that it doesn't like to fly, but it can if it has to. And so Basically, the scientists suggest that earlier versions of the rat types could fly. So the ostrich could, you know, like you said, big wings where the emu doesn't. And so a lot of the reason they can't fly is because they don't have obviously they're big, they're heavier, but they don't have that keel bone that we talk about. We've talked about that in some birds.
Yeah. It's like a breastbone where where the wings attach to.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the pectoral muscles.
Pectoral muscles.
Yeah. So like if carve a turkey for those that eat meat, you know, you go and you have that large breastbone in the middle. That's because they fly, you know, turkeys can fly and a lot of these other birds can fly. Well, the ratites are the ones that can't fly, don't have that bone. It's flat. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the tinamous does. So they do have a keeled sternum, but again, they don't fly as much. But DNA and genetics has put them all together, so there's no doubt that that is part of that family.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in the order is the cassiforms. So this goes down to the cassowary and emu. So they're in their own order. So we did cover episode 79 was cassowary. One of my favorites, dad of the year. That's one of my favorite funny stories. Mom lays an egg, walks off, and dad does the rest.
Oh, yes.
So great. Family is Cassowaridae, same as above. Your cassowary is emus. Now, the genus is Dromaeus, and the species name is a mouthful. Dromaeus Novae Hollandiae. It is a big one. Novae Hollandiae. Noven Hollandiae. Yeah, I don't know who named the emu, but geez, thank you. Now, there were subspecies, Angie. This is where...
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It was, I had no idea. And some small ones, right?
Yeah. Dwarf emus. They were on Kangaroo Island, King Island. Europeans came along. They're extinct. And then in Tasmania, they had a subspecies that became extinct 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. So Europeans, this looks like good food. And then boom, ate them. Now, the ratites, again, are birds evolving way back when dinosaurs were still around 100 million years ago. The initial thought with these classes of birds was in the supercontinent Gondwana. It split, and these birds kind of were on the rafts. But DNA has put some of this in debate because what I found interesting is the kiwi is... the most closest related to the elephant bird,
right,
which is in Madagascar.
That. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes no sense. The kiwi in New Zealand, where I'm at, is more closely related to the elephant bird, which was in Madagascar that went extinct 500 years ago, I think they think it was the last one was killed. Mm-hmm. So that was very interesting. Obviously, the emu and cassowary are really closely related. The moa, which was one of the tallest until the elephant bird came around, here in New Zealand, that went extinct about 300 years ago. About 300 years ago when they went extinct, is most closely related to the tinamous, which is in the Americas.
All over the map, Chris.
And then you have the rheas. And then you have the ostriches, which are just of their own separate family, which is weird. You would think elephant birds and ostrich would be more closely related. So this DNA studies, and it's not just one, there's been a few of them, has thrown a lot of the origin of ratites into disarray. We honestly don't know how they kind of evolved with there. And again, their bones don't fossilize as well. So it's kind of tougher sometimes. Yeah, the tallest bird ever that we know of was the elephant bird. And they called it that because Arab traders thought it was a bird that could carry an elephant away.
Right. I love that.
Yeah. So they thought it was
That's how big the bird is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was 10 feet tall, like 1,600 pounds, 700 kilograms. Goodness. It was massive, massive. So whenever we talk about the ratites, yeah, that was the biggest, like bulkiest ratite ever. So yeah, fun stuff always with them. Now here again, this is where emus, it just, it's so interesting compared to say an ostrich. Ostriches, we talked about them, they can live on average up to 50 years, right? 40-50 years. Mm-hmm. The oldest one we think of lived up somewhere 70 something years under human care, but still lived a long time. Emus, 10 years in the wild, maybe up to 20 years under human care. That's such a big difference in the two birds.
Yeah, they have a lot more hardships, I think, out in wild. The big periods of starvation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it can be tough being a wild emu, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That doesn't include having an army after you also.
They're better at surviving that, yeah. Dodging, zigging.
Seriously.
And zagging machine gun bullets. Oh, I love you, emus. Now, I can ask you, who's faster, ostrich or emu? You probably know that. I stumped you.
I'm going to have to say I know emus are faster than cassowaries, but I'm going to have to go with ostriches just because they're that much taller and their legs are that much longer.
Are you sure?
Maybe.
You're right, though.
Okay, good. Trickster.
I just said that because going back, this is so long ago. Did we interview him during the Xander, when Xander was like young? Xander's near in teenage years now. And he was telling me how the platypus lived in the Amazon River. And I was like, are you sure? And he's like, yep, like, yeah, double down.
Oh, that hasn't changed. He will triple down. And I'm always working on it. Like, I'm like, honey, sometimes it's better to be kind than to be right. Okay. Yeah. We're working on that one. But
it's good thought process. Yes. Ostriches are definitely faster. 40 miles per hour. That's like 60 something kilometers per hour. Emus only reach speeds of 30 miles per hour or 50 kilometers per hour.
Which is still really fast.
Yeah. And ostriches, look at all the predators. I mean, there's predators in obviously in Australia. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have cheetah, leopard, lion, hyena, you know, all these things that can chase an ostrich. Whereas in the emu, you have dingoes, obviously, that have only been around 50,000 years, but they haven't wiped the emu out. So, you know, I'm saying 50,000 years is when the dingo was introduced, or what we think was introduced to Australia, anywhere from 25 to 50,000 years ago, if I remember that right, because they came with the Aborigines.
Yeah, that was a good episode a while back.
Yeah, yeah, dingoes. And so
episode 243.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one. I love our Aussie animals. So, yeah, I mean, the emus didn't have to be as fast.
Right.
To some of these others, right? Okay. Mm-hmm.
But their feet and legs are designed for running, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they have those. Emus have 3 forward-facing toes and no rear-facing toes. Whereas the ostrich, Chris, it's really weird. They only have 2 toes on each foot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, talk about dinosaur feet. Like, if you want to see what a dinosaur foot looks like, you know, at a stoplight, I mean, I said with Melody yesterday, or wherever you are, just Google like ostrich feet or emu feet. And that to me is what a dinosaur foot looks like. Like, that's
for
what the footprints. Yeah.
For sure.
The footprints that we find.
And for the emu, too, is similar to their cassowary cousin, and then they have a really sharp claw on their toe, which they will use for defensive mechanism, and with kick to an opponent, either during breeding season or if they are being preyed upon or something. And this claw on the toe can be up to 6 inches or 15 centimeters in length.
So why was I standing 2 feet from an emu getting a selfie? And the cassowaries behind like barbed wire fencing. Like,
because, Chris, I think you might be one of those New Zealanders that moved to Australia, buddy.
Thank you.
But I'm bump.
Okay.
I gotta stick up for Australia a little bit over here. Right,
there you go. You got me. You got me.
You shouldn't be. Yes. That is, I think that's the message of the moral story.
It was in a free ranging where like you had the kangaroos and
well, hopefully those the keepers or the owners know that their emus are extra loving.
I guess. I mean, they're just not as worried about them. But we busted that myth with the cassowary. There's like no, they can really hurt you, but maybe they're more territorial. I don't know.
Yeah, I think in general that what I was reading with emus and their behavior is they do have powerful legs and they can kick and they do have these sharp claws on their toes. But in general, they're so fast, that's going to be their primary mechanism of survival. It's just run. Mm-hmm. So whereas I think the cassowary is a little opposite. They're like, let's go. Like, they're looking for a fight, basically.
Well, it's backed up with leg muscle, too. I think the emus have, they call it a calf muscle. I pulled up a study on the physiology and I have the picture of it in front of me. It's not a calf muscle like we think of our calves because they have a long foot bone, but they're very muscular, the shoulder down.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, emus are unique. For all the bird species, in that they have this calf muscle, also known as a gastrocnemius. Mm-hmm. So it's like in humans, it would be somewhat, the location would be similar to our calf muscle. It's just more elevated for, like it's a slightly different location for them.
Yeah.
And the human calf muscle, it's so cute. When I used to teach anatomy and physiology to my nursing students, I would always remind them that the gastrocnemius, the reason it was named that is because in humans, the calf muscle, it has like 2 bundles. And I guess some scientists or whatever thought it looked like 2 little bellies. So the gastro is actually in reference to your belly.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
So they call it like little bellies. Anyways, it's just a trick to help remember the names of, because of course, in science, you can't just call it a calf muscle. It has to be called the gastrocnemius if you're doing anatomy and physiology. And so, yeah, but the emu, I think, has three bundles. So they have, it looks somewhat differently, but it's pretty, makes their legs really powerful, right? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty unique to the emus. So
yeah,
it's probably used more for the speed and the running than the actual kicking, but they, but they definitely can, they can kick if they need to.
Well, yeah. I mean, the dingoes, they have to defend themselves against dingoes. Mm-hmm. It's a natural predator. There's some eagles out there that can prey on some adult emus. And then obviously the chicks are more prone to introduce foxes and cats and feral dogs, you know, besides dingoes and other birds of prey. So not easy out there.
No. Well, and what I didn't realize, we always think of emus as running fast, but they also have a really decent vertical jump. So I take that back earlier in the episode. I guess they probably could jump over some of the farmers' fences. Yeah. They say that if the emus are running, they can get 2.1 meters or about 6.8 feet off the ground, which is no
That's
joke.
Over my head. That's over
and this
my
is
head.
With no wings, right? They have this little vestigial, vestigial wings.
That's all legs.
So, yeah. And then the other thing, I need to see this to believe it, but they also said that they're really strong swimmers.
Mm.
For some reason, that I have a really hard time visualizing. So we'll have to scour YouTube for that. And living in Australia, of course, emus have adopted several other adaptations to make them these incredible generalists that can live many different places and eat lots of different things, which we'll talk about, nutrition. And one of these adaptations that I thought was really awesome is their eyelids. And so an emu has two sets of eyelids. Mm-hmm. So a normal one, like we think of us humans having, where it'll blink and it helps lubricate the eye. And then they have a second transparent set of eyelids that basically will go over their eye to keep out dust when they're running.
Mm.
So yeah, that way they can actually see where they're running without actually getting dirt in their eyes. So
yeah.
That always reminds me of the camels have the thick eyelashes to help protect them. But yeah, this second eyelid is a pretty cool adaptation to help keep them seeing clear while they run fast. And another really cool behavioral adaptation that the emus have come up with is this migration that Chris talked about briefly. And in different parts of Australia, of course, the rainfall can be somewhat seasonal and, of course, unpredictable or sparse. And so researchers think the emus actually tend to shift some of their migration based on rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
And that because it's based on rainfall, emus rely on cues about rain in the area, which means that they can hear and interpret sounds of thunder from really, really far away, smell wet ground that might be miles and miles away, or even rely on the clouds, like looking at them and saying, as us humans sometimes do, like, oh, that looks like a rain cloud in this direction, and then go from there. So it's very well noted that the how they migrate is based on rainfall. And so they think that there's these awesome cues that they've adapted over time to learn how to get to the rain or get to water in their favor. So
probably just psychic, you know, they're just psychic.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how they figured out. Okay, they're coming to set up these machine guns. We'll wave and
we got them.
Show our fannies and then take off running. And good luck.
Yeah,
they're amazing.
It's like a sixth sense. Pretty cool.
That's a fun.
Regardless, I want to learn more about them. That's for sure.
Yeah. No, they are. They are amazing. Well, it's some of the things they eat. They're mainly herbivores. So when we talk about again that seed dispersion, fruits. Other plants that they'll do that, but they do eat some insects, maybe some small animals if they can catch them, you know, being curious about a bird, but mainly that, you know, they're herbivores. And one of the things is they don't drink as often. So like Angie said, water is a big thing because a lot of part of Australia, I'm thinking of like the 40 degrees Celsius or 110 degree heat out in the deserts, you know, those birds and they survive.
Yeah,
they
do want daily access to fresh water. And and this migration, I probably didn't mention it previously because I was so enthralled by how they migrate with the rain. or knowing where it's going to rain. But yeah, I mean, they go hundreds of miles to find food and water sources during their migration. And they ideally would like to have access to fresh water, especially when they are migrating and if it's not during breeding season. So yeah, I mean, in that case, they won't be super picky with what they eat, but they are smart about what they eat. When they get a chance, they try to concentrate their nutrients and eat like young shoots from plants or the seeds, as Chris mentioned, or fruits or flowers or things that are going to have more nutrition and pack a bigger punch per pound than dried grasses or old leaves and stuff like that. I thought it was interesting too, is that emus have no crop, which that's the anatomical feature in birds, but instead they have an esophagus that has been modified to store food for about 30 minutes before it actually enters the stomach.
Yeah.
So it is pretty common to see an emu ingesting pebbles to help grind their food up as well. And sometimes charkel. So
There you go. Well, yeah, I mean, they are built for surviving in these rough, harsh environments.
Yeah, and they will store a lot of fat when they do come across a lot of food. They'll definitely fatten up, which will...
Yeah, and they lose like half of it when they migrate, right? Like they can lose a lot of body mass. Mm-hmm. Well, behaviors, I mean, it's so far what we've covered. Like they can dodge bullets, they can... to predict the rain. What are some of the other things that they do? They're amazing. These are...
Well, they're fun. They're fun to watch. They're very playful and very curious with each other, with other animals. So if they are under human care, make sure the next time you go to your accredited zoo to watch the emus, because you'll definitely be entertained. They're a fun creature. They're moving around. And of course, they're curious as a generalist. They're always looking for food, right? Like that's in their DNA, like must find food at all times. But in general, they're active during the day and they will hunker down at night, although they wake up a lot of times throughout the night, always worried about predators and threats and things like that. So they sleep pretty light. Emu is typically a solitary bird, but can also exhibit these social behaviors and get along with birds when they need to. I don't know. Combat the Australian army.
Army.
Or, you know, eat farmers' crops or whatever it is. So they can sometimes be seen sharing nests or searching for food together. And for some of these migrations, you'll see large groups migrate all at once from one food source to the next food source. So they can, like I said, they'd be very pleasant, get along with themselves and then with other animals as well. Unless it's egg incubation time. And then the cassowary in them comes out. And we'll talk about that a little bit when we get to reproduction.
What social behaviors, that what was that booming we heard?
Yeah.
That we started with. Yeah.
Right. That's emus being friendly, talking to each other, communicating to one another. And they make that booming sound, which can be heard up to about 2 kilometers away. Oh. They make that sound by using like an inflatable neck sack. Or it's also called like a tracheal pouch. And so during breeding season, it'll become more prominent and it will basically allow for the sound to be made. And so, Chris, other than the booming signature call that they're known for, they can also grunt and whistle. And they're also known to make like a signature emu sound as well, which is where they got their name from, the emu. So, yeah, they definitely are a bird that can express lots of different vocal communication tactics. And in addition to these different vocalizations, they'll use their body language as well to help communicate their feelings with other other emus.
So that gets me into, so how do they feel? I guess because you always, whenever we come to birds, it's just the first thing I think
it's
of.
It's fun. The courtship is always so unique.
Courtship behaviors. And you're always like, I want John to do this bird. And I want John to do that bird. And it just always comes in my head. So what does courtship look like? Or what are some of the behaviors?
Well, I definitely want John to be like an emu and take care of the children while I'm out and about. And I'm just kidding.
He does.
Yes. Today I went swimming. Yeah. He had the kiddos. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the horse farm. So, yes, he is a very emu dad. He is the emu for me, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they're great dads, and we'll talk about that. But first, we have to talk about their courtship behaviors. Emus are polyandrous breeders, So not all, but some females will engage with multiple partners. And depending on where they live in Australia, the breeding season or mating season will be from December to January. Mm-hmm. And it usually starts with females selecting males and then engaging in a courtship dance. And during this time, it's actually common to see the females fighting for a male that they have interest in.
There you go.
So those
that's rare.
Those claws will come out when the girls are when the girls are feeling it, and they see a male emu that they like. But once that happens and the male's interested as well, the female emu will start making some of these booming drum-like sounds. Mm-hmm. And if the male decides that she's of interest to him and he's of interest to her and back and forth, they'll start to engage in a courtship dance. And so the dance is going to be some struts and snake-like head movements. Yes, John, if you're listening, I would like more of that in our life. Thank you very much. A little dance moves is always good. And the female is also sussing the male out. Even though she likes what she sees visually, she needs to see some of his dance moves to really help her seal the deal and for things to move forward. So it's important that he dances well and looks good with his strutting and his head snaking. Otherwise, she might change her mind, or sometimes she can actually become aggressive, I guess, which is not very nice. And so whether or not they breed ends up being dependent on the male's performance and how the female feels about it, even though she fought to get his attention in the beginning. Actually, a lot of this sounds very human-esque, right?
Like, yeah.
It goes back and forth and back and forth. It's not just both parties are involved in the selection, but it's at the very final stages, the female will suss him up for some of his courtship or dance moves. The really fascinating part with emus is once they breed, the male will start making a nest, and he makes very diligent about doing it. And the female may lay anywhere from 5 to 24 eggs. So
that's
a fair amount of eggs. Yeah. And Christy, eggs are just stunning. I don't know if you've ever seen an emu egg, but they're gorgeous. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're deep green with blue hues. They almost look like a glossy avocado, and they're of course they're pretty big in size, not as big as the ostrich's egg, right, but good size and really, really beautiful. And once she lays her eggs, she's done. The male will take over and incubate the eggs for about 50 to 56 days. He sits and he waits, and he aggressively defends his nest. And the male emu during this incubation times of his eggs does not eat anything, drink anything, or even pass any feces or any waste.
He's just there.
Yep, he lives off there. Of fat that's been stored. Mm-hmm. He's just there. And the male emu is in it to win it.
What is with this? Cassowaries emus. They are the top dogs. Top dads. Top dads.
Such
of the
top
bird
dads.
World. And I will say the great hornbill too, who she loses all of his feathers and he is constantly flying back and forth, feeding them both, all the chicks. So there's a lot of great bird dads.
Yeah. And the female emu, bless her heart, she isn't done. She will breed with other males. Female emus can actually store sperm as well. Mm-hmm. So, and this is not every female, but she might actually lay another clutch. She may continue laying eggs every 3, 4, 5 days after her initial clutch was laid.
She's busy.
She's very busy, but it can come at a cost, because if she's running around doing all these things and having all these eggs, if there's not a male around, she can risk them not being incubated. So it's not always perfect for the female emu. She doesn't have it all figured out. But that's it for the female. She doesn't have any interest in seeing those eggs hatch.
Again, same thing. It's the same. I didn't read it because I wanted to be surprised. So you're telling me they are exact same thing. The emu dads raise the chicks just like the cassowary dad.
Yes. And not only do
yes.
raise the chicks, but they are like really, really, really good dads. They take care of them. They take great pride in protecting, obviously, not only their nest, but also their chicks. And so after hatching, the males protect the flock. So anywhere from 5 to 24, I think 24 is obviously on the high end, and basically teach them how to feed themselves. He gets them up and around, shows them the ropes, especially if they're a generalist, on different types of foods that they eat, what predators are. And the male will, once again, aggressively defend his chicks, not only to other emus, but even to the mother if she crosses their path. So pretty unique in the bird world. And then the male emu hangs out and sticks with the chicks at least up until they're independent, like up to seven months until
that's crazy.
That's big and
nuts.
Grown.
And
emus have a little bit slower generation interval where they really become independent around 15 to 18 months. But he's keeping with them for half a year, making sure that they're alive and doing what they're supposed to do. And yeah, the female, I mean, she's just out there eating bugs and seeds and.
I mean, okay, we go back to cassowary, and if you haven't heard that episode, we were amazed. Incredible, incredible dads. I will give the females credit. They use up a lot of resources to produce those eggs, a lot of body reserves.
Thank you. Amen. I still have those body reserves that I stored.
it's like we go the emperor penguins, the whole march of the penguins. The males are there for so long hatching the eggs. Females finally come back so the males can go eat. There's so much that goes into that egg laying and producing that. But hats off to the emu dads. Aussie dads, you're amazing. I know many
you
of them.
You are.
You Aussie dads.
Yeah, and of course, Aussie moms are great too.
But obviously they are, yeah.
Obviously. But the dads too, the emu nest is flat. It's not like big and round like you maybe think of a nest in a tree or something. And so the eggs will roll away. And so the dads have to really make sure that the eggs don't roll away. Mm-hmm. And they're turning them every couple hours. So they're not eating, they're not drinking. I mean, it's really impressive. And so, yes, cheers.
Well, you got to look out for those Aussie moms, like the qualth that eats their babies. But yeah, the ones that don't make it.
Well, like I said, the moms have to do all the physiological hard work. So, you know what? If somebody will babysit our eggs once in a while, like let it happen. Let it happen.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. I love birds. Well, our emus are doing well, like Angie said, around 700,000 plus. But they are... There is still more development going on, mining going on, habitat loss is a thing, fragmentation.
Yeah, and I was reading that the emu population in New South Wales, North Coast Bioregion and Port Stephens have emus listed as endangered in those areas by the New South Wales government.
Yeah, I mean,
so certain populations.
Yeah, near big cities, urbanization. All of those things are definitely a danger to these birds, but as a species overall, surviving.
Yeah. And I didn't realize too, the emus were reintroduced to Tasmania as well.
Right. So they are, in certain parts where, again, 1865 is when they were eradicated or hunted to extinction there. So now organizations, we love our Aussie organizations. We've been covering quite a bit.
Oh yes, Chris. I'm really excited about the group this week. Huge shout out to Australian Wildlife Conservancy. They can be found at australianwildlife.org. And this is one of the world's largest conservation organizations, and they have done a lot to conserve almost 13 million hectares in different areas throughout Australia, which of course is meaning land for several different species of native Australian wildlife. The programs are just incredible. The Australian Wildlife Conservancy looks out for ecological health monitoring, research, feral fox and cat control, feral herbivore control, I think that means bunnies, fire management, weed control, wildlife translocations. So many programs that are looking out for the land and the animals, the native animals that inhabit it. Hats off to Australian Wildlife Conservancy. Check them out at australianwildlife.org. And of course, on all your favorite social media platforms, give them a like and a follow, and you can learn more about this organization and what they're doing and how you can also help, especially if you're from Australia. But even if you're from far away, there's tons of other ways to get involved, and their website's really well done. I learned a lot. There are tons of news. They have a really great newsletter that you can subscribe to, and they'll let you know what's going on and all the updates and on different environmental issues that are happening.
Yeah, no, great. Thank you for the work you're doing in Australia. You know, thank you for preserving all your species and fighting for them. I know there's many that listen to this podcast involved in that, involved in the work or care. You know, you do care. So, you know, we thank you so much for listening. I loved my time there. It's fine. You're right. When I leave New Zealand, the IQ goes up and Australia's goes up. Australia's goes down, whatever it is, that joke. I tell that tongue in cheek because I know Aussies like to dish it out too. And I cannot wait to get back over there this year to see you and see more of your wild spaces and zoos and animal conservation centers. So thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening. Share your emu photos with us. Once again, we're All Creatures Podcast at Facebook and Instagram. We would love to see more of those birds in actions, especially if there's one of them swimming, but just in general, that iconic blue hued neck and their crazy shaggy feathery heads. I can't get enough. So thank you for listening, learning, conserving. And once again, a huge shout out to Nick. Happy birthday. This emu is for you, buddy.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.